Case number 10-1130 et al. Lois Lowe, petitioner v. Surface Transportation Board et al. Mr. Strohmeyer for the petitioner Strohmeyer. Mr. Riffin for intervener Riffin. Mr. Bowles from respondent STB. And Mr. Spittelnick for intervener MTA.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Eric Strohmeyer. I'm one of the petitioners in this proceeding. I'd like to just briefly start off with just a few comments on just one point. The question that we had raised was, did this decision require the agency to make an interpretation of the final system plan? It was raised in number three of our opening brief filed by Ms. Lowe. And my concern with this is we have seen a number of decisions and pleadings that had been made in this proceeding which established or attempted to establish the various endpoints of the line of railroad in question. And our big concern here is that we still do not know as of this date precisely where the endpoint is. And my big concern is that an interpretation of the final system plan is required or would have been required by the agency in order to have reached a conclusion that it did in this proceeding in granting the abandonment application. And that's the one point that I'd like to solely focus on today.
See,
in finance document...
You don't think that the whole, I don't know how to pronounce it, Coxleyville Industrial Tract is sought to be abandoned?
Was that?
You don't think that the entirety of the, let's call it CIT, was intended to be abandoned? You think that there may be 200 feet left over unabandoned, or what?
Well, actually, my position with respect to this is that we don't know where the end precisely is, and you have to determine the end point before you can determine whether or not it is or isn't in its entirety. The problem is the final system plan stated that the endpoint was milepost 15.4. And in finance document number 34975, after prodding by the STB, the Maryland Transit Administration in that proceeding went through a very extensive explanation of providing a explanation as to where the endpoint of the rail line was. And they said it was 15.4. And so we have the final system plan says 15.4, and then we have the Maryland Transit Administration says 15.4, and then Norfolk Southern, who had originally, almost 6 years ago, had an abandonment application rejected because they couldn't identify where the endpoints were. Now, that was clarified in finance docket 34975, but in the current proceeding, which the decision we have asked for you to review today, Norfolk Southern says, I have more than what the state of Maryland and the final system plan conveyed. And our question is, well, if you're claiming that there's more, you have to interpret the final system plan to see whether or not do you really have something greater than 15.4? Because in essence, you've already argued twice in the final system, or there's been a finding in the final system plan of 15.4, and you have a Maryland Transit Administration argued 15.4, that's the end point. That's sort of like the left foul pole, for lack of a better word. So we seem to know where that point is, and then Norfolk Southern says, well, it may not be at that point, and then places into the record an argument that says, well, it may result as an issue of potentially rounding. Well, the problem is the final system plan on its face doesn't account for the issue of rounding. And that was a concern that I had, which is in order to conclude that you can, in fact, go to 15.44, you then have to interpret, does the final system plan allow for that explanation which Norfolk Southern placed into the record? It still comes back to it requires the agency to interpret the final system plan to determine where the endpoint of the line is. A second question would be, did the agency exceed its jurisdiction by granting relief beyond the end of the line, because its jurisdiction ends at the end of the line. And it's in that point that I wanted to argue before this court today and raise the issue that I believe that the agency, in order to grant 15.44, would have had to have interpreted the final system plan in order to do that. And in Conrail v. SDB, this court has said you can't interpret the final system plan. And that's a concern that I had, and it's the issue that I wanted to bring to the court's attention today.
Thank you. All right, intervener, and you are appearing both on behalf of yourself and Mrs. Lowe.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning. Lovely day. It was just asked, why is the final system plan important? Why is an interpretation of it important? As Your Honor just pointed out, they wanted to abandon it to the end. It's important to know where the end is because Ms. Lowe, myself, Mr. Strohmeyer, and two other individuals have a high desire to acquire the line to the end and would like to know where is the end. And the reason we want to know that is because there are two significantly different places where the inn might be. Hurricane Agnes washed out the railroad bridge that crossed where this line crosses Beaver Dam Run. That's at about milepost 15.3 something. I know where a bridge is. It's 15.31, and it's a couple hundred feet from where the Beaver Dam Run bridge is. Another 1,800 feet up the line, there's another creek, Western Run. That bridge is intact today. And the question is, where's the end of the line? Is it at Western Run or Beaver Dam Run? That's a difference of about a third of a mile. That's a very significant difference, of some significance. What did Conrail convey to the Maryland Transit Administration? The deed says to the south side of Bridge 16. We don't know where Bridge 16 is. What we do know is there is a bridge at 15.96. There's another one at 15.56, another one at 15.44, and another one at 15.31, and I think there's another one about 15.04. And what we also know is that the respondents have argued it's not the 15.96 bridge, it's Bridge 16. It's not that one. And I would assume that would be the one, because that's closest to 16. If this court vacates the decision, and we get an opportunity to put in our offer of financial assistance to acquire the line, we want to acquire it to the end, wherever it might be. And we'd like to know, where's the end? Also, a particular significance. In the previous proceedings, the board actually stated in its decision, we don't know where this line is. We don't know something about the branch lines. In any future proceeding, we would like that you address these issues of where is this line, where does it start, where does it end, and we'd like for you to address the branch lines, because there are three branch lines that come off the Coffeysville Industrial Track. Ms. Lowe has argued, and I concur, that these three branch lines are lines of railroad. And if they're lines of railroad, you need permission, authority, to abandon them. And if you abandon the main line, Coffeysville Industrial Track, you're leaving three stranded segments. And we've learned in Anton Cato that stranded segments are not to be tolerated. If you're going to abandon, you need to abandon all of it, not just some of it. Ms. Lowe's main concern, and it's a major concern of mine, is the lack of due process in this case. And I have another one, which is equal protection. As this court well knows, we have another case that's in Colorado. And in the Colorado case, a gentleman that was the city manager of the city of Creed, Colorado, filed a pleading, and it's not in this case, Your Honor, if you're looking for it, I'm just telling you about it because this is the equal protection. In that proceeding, the board permitted the city manager of the city of Creed to represent over half a dozen different peoples. This city manager is not an attorney. In their decision, they actually relied upon his representations. In this proceeding, what happened? We have pleadings that were filed by Ms. Lowe and others. They were all combined into one pleading for administrative convenience. Everyone signed them individually. And the board said, because they've got my name on it, we're going to strike them with regard to the other four parties. We're going to strike it because you didn't tell us your address, even though everybody's using the same address, 1941 Green Spring Drive, which is my address.
Precisely. And I find it, precisely.
Beg your pardon?
Precisely.
It may be my address, but it's also not exclusively my address.
Is it a residence or a business address?
This is a business. It's an office building. I happen to own the office building. But it has a number of tenants. So it's not just my address. It's the address of the various tenants also. And this building does not distinguish between suite A, B, C, whatever.
And these people are tenants?
I beg your pardon?
Are the other individuals in question tenants in the building?
They are with regard to receiving mail at this place. Yes, they do have a tenancy of a very small portion of the building, which gives them the legal right to receive their mail at this building.
Recall Mrs. Lowe making that argument.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I have a hard time hearing.
I'm sorry. I don't recall Mrs. Lowe making that argument, that she claimed to be a tenant.
She hasn't made that argument. What she has made the argument is that the statute, the regulation says, give us an address, an address.
It says petitioner's address.
Petitioner's address. Well, what is petitioner's address? Do they want your residence? She decidedly didn't want that in the record. Is it your business address? Is it your post office box if you have one? It's your address is whatever. Now, what I find disconcerting is that what is the argument of the board? The board is arguing we need your address in order to identify you. And they make that argument over and over and over. We need to know your identity. Well, that's fine. Don't have a problem with that. But what's your address got to do with your identity? Nothing. You can use any address you want. If you rent a post office box, who owns the box? You don't. You merely have permission to use it for a period of time. And in this particular case, Ms. Lowe and the others had permission, and still do to this day, have permission to use this address as their address of record. The purpose of an address is to give someone who wants to serve you with process a place to serve you that process.
Ah, but the board has an additional purpose.
The board has a what?
The board has an additional purpose.
What's the additional purpose? It's not identity because it has nothing to do with identity.
Well, the board's opinion says it needs to know a person's address because it's trying to determine whether or not it's financially suitable to take over the line.
Where you live? No, I shouldn't say where you live. I should say where you get your mail.
In other words, if Mrs. Lowe had said, my address is Mr. Riffin's commercial office building where I receive mail, maybe we'd have a different case. But the board said that's not what she said. She gave your address.
She didn't actually say it's my address. If you read the regulations...
That's the problem. That's what the board says is the problem. She didn't identify your building as her address.
What I find of significance is the address that she changed it to, Mr. Delmont's office building instead of my office building, that was a perfectly acceptable address. Mm-hmm. It's still not her address. And in fact, at that address, she has even less of a right to be there. Mm-hmm. She's just using it as a point of convenience. She knows she doesn't want to use her residence mm-hmm. for privacy purposes. She needs a place where she can receive papers, service.
So your argument is what?
My argument is
that the board's interpretation of its own regulation is arbitrary and capricious?
I'm arguing that it was arbitrary and capricious for the board to say, you can't use 1941 because that's associated with Griffin, but you can use 50 Scott Adam, even though that's associated with Mr. Domont. It has nothing, because it has nothing to do with Griffin.
I understand. That's
Griffin is what it is their concern is. So it's a due process. I think it's a due process issue. It's an equal protection issue.
Assuming the board was wrong on that.
I couldn't understand.
Assuming the board was wrong on that, what consequences flowed that injured you?
Ms. Lowe, her pleadings were struck on the 22nd of March. She learned that some days thereafter. She didn't know, and in fact, in the 22nd of March decision, it expressly says,
she corrected it 4 days later. So, assuming that anything consequential happened on the 22nd of March, it seems to have been reversed on the 26th. So, and actually, she was free to file papers from January 5 on, and did.
The board instructed.
Notice explicitly says she's free to file papers. Doesn't say she, it's interested parties.
The board basically said, we're not going to permit you to make any more filings. We're going to strike all of your filings until you give us an address other than Riffin's address. And she did. But she still didn't know. Am I allowed to participate? And when did she find out that she could participate? On the same day the decision was made. That's due process. You need notice and a reasonable time to respond, and the board did not give Ms. Lowe that. And I find that very disconcerting.
The ruling explicitly states this ruling does not preclude any financially responsible person from submitting an offer of financial assistance in this proceeding at the proper time. I think it was late by that time, consistent with the board's rules. So I'm still searching for actual harm from the March ruling.
The most significant harm, Your Honor, has to do with exempting the proceeding from the OFA procedures.
But it didn't. I don't understand
that.
Oh,
they very much exempted it from the OFA proceedings.
You're free to submit offers of financial assistance. That's what the very ruling you're complaining about says.
She made an attempt to file a protective order, and they struck it. The protective order is what has her financial information in it. She didn't know that she could resubmit it until the day that the decision was made.
Well, it says,
which is too late.
Submitting an offer of financial assistance. That seems to allow,
in addition,
basically what you wanted to do.
The critical thing is, when are the financial information, when is it due? It's not due before the board grants the permission to abandon. The clock starts running when they grant the petition to abandon, and you have 10 days thereafter to file it. But in this case, they didn't get their 10 days because the board exempted it. And that's another issue that I find disconcerting. The board in its decision says we have no indication of shipper interest. And what they had on the day of the decision in the protective order that I filed was an indication that there were a significant number of shippers that had an interest in shipping on this line. Dozen or so, up to 4,000 plus rail cars a year. That's a fair amount of traffic.
Why don't we hear from the representative, counsel for the board?
Okay,
why don't we hear from counsel for the board, and we'll give you a couple of minutes.
Very good, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Excuse me. My name is James Bolzen, here on behalf of the board and United States. With me at council table is Mr. Charles Spitolnik, representing the Maryland Transit Administration intervener in this case. As you know, the board has taken 10 minutes for argument. MTA has taken five. Now, we've delved pretty far into this case, but...
Mr. Bowles, if you'll raise the podium.
Oh, of course. The podium?
It's a little button on your right.
Oh, I see it. The curse of being 6 foot. Is that better, Your Honor?
Yes, thank you.
The petitioners claim that during the December 2009 abandonment exemption proceeding before the board, that their due process rights were violated and that the board ultimately rendered a decision that was not supported by substantial evidence in the record. However, a review of their claims and of the record establishes that the petitioners received all the process that they were due. They do not contest that they received notice of the event, but the record also establishes that they had substantial and meaningful opportunities to participate and that they were given upfront the means by which they could successfully participate in the proceedings before the board. The record also establishes that the board, in weighing the evidence that was presented by MTA and Norfolk Southern against the somewhat more speculative evidence that was presented by Mr. Riffin, properly found that the Norfolk Southern petition for exemption was well-founded and should be granted.
When you say given the means up front, you mean through the board's regulations?
I'm sorry, say again?
About the due process argument, when you say they were given the means up front, are you referring to the board's regulations?
I am, Your Honor, and also referring to the Federal Register notice that was issued on January 5th, which actually contained a roadmap describing the deadlines by which all these materials were due, exactly what was required, and when the board would be making its ultimate decision on the merits. Norfolk Southern filed its petition for exemption seeking exemption from the requirements of 49 U.S.C. Section 10903, which governs the abandonment of freight rail lines, and Section 10904, which allows third parties like Mr. Riffin to come in, participate in the process, and make offers of financial assistance and thereby either acquire or subsidize the line it's slated for abandonment. Do you have a question, Your Honor? No. The Norfolk Southern sought this exemption because it was seeking to abandon the Cockeysville Industrial Track, a 13.25-mile segment running between Cockeysville, Maryland, and Baltimore, Maryland. Norfolk Southern specifically noted that it was abandoning ancillary track, such as the Cockeysville Industrial Park Track, which the petitioners now say is stranded. However, that argument is clearly based on a misapprehension of the record. Because the Norfolk Southern noticed the Cockeysville Industrial Park track and those ancillary tracks for abandonment, then there is no stranded segment. They've been abandoned. It does not matter whether or not the CIPT was a line of railroad or spur or just ancillary track or switching track. It has been abandoned. It is not stranded. As I mentioned before, the board on June 5th published that roadmap, that Federal Register notice. That notice established that there would be an environmental assessment available for comment 60 days after the petitioner filed its petition, that all comments, protests, and evidence supporting that information was due on January 25th, and that the board would make its final decision on April 5th of 2010. Now, a few days after, immediately upon that filing, the petitioners filed a whole host of documents. They filed a notice of intent to participate as part of your record. They filed a notice of their intent to file an OFA. They filed their comments where they supported the Norfolk Southern effort to abandon, but they resisted the effort to get the transaction exempted from the OFA process. And they filed their motion for protective order so that they could shield their confidential information when they put it into the record to support their case. Now, a few days after those filings, Norfolk Southern filed a motion to strike, which mentioned two problems. One, that it appeared that Mr. Riffin was representing the petitioners, Mr. Strohmeyer and Ms. Lowe, either in the capacity of counsel or as a board practitioner, but that Mr. Riffin was qualified to do neither. The Norfolk Southern also noticed that Ms. Lowe and Mr. Strohmeyer had failed to include their address, as this court has already discussed. The filing that they made specifically indicates that the address that they were including was Mr. Riffin's address. And it is quite telling that at the end of this process, when Ms. Lowe made her corrective filings on March 26th, she did not use the Green Spring Drive address that Mr. Riffin had identified, but instead identified another address as her own and specifically stated that that was her address. Now, of course, Mr. Riffin and now seems to suggest that that is also not her address. But that technical noncompliance was not what the board was weighing at the time. On March 22nd, the board said you have to describe something as your address if you are properly identified, and Ms. Lowe appeared to comply with that requirement. It is also quite telling that on March 4th, before the board even made its decision as to the merits of the motion to strike, Mr. Strohmeyer anticipated the board's decision and filed a new set of filings that actually contained his identification. So Mr. Strohmeyer figured out how to comply with 49 CFR 1104.1, which has the identification requirement. So these things were available to the petitioners. Now, Mr. Strohmeyer and Mr. Riffin have expressed concern about the final system plan, about the definition of the CIT. However, an examination of the record suggests that these are all based on misapprehensions. There are no stranded segments, as I just mentioned a moment ago. This entire, all of that line and all of the lines that are pertinent to it have been abandoned. But in addition, the board examined evidence presented by Norfolk Southern, which established that the end of the CIT was milepost 15.44. Now, again and again, the board has struggled on this during this appeal to deal with evidence and arguments that were not actually made before the board. Mr. Strohmeyer and Mr. Riffin were before the board and had every opportunity to make these arguments and give the board a chance to build the record to respond to these comments. But they are effectively sandbagging the board now and ignoring the requirements of Tucker Truck that arguments that are going to be made on appeal need to be made before the agency in order that the record be created. Your Honors, the issue about the imprecision of the endpoint of the CIT, the board looked at the evidence, specifically what was deeded over to Norfolk Southern from Conrail, and examined all of the filings associated with that, and came to the conclusion that the end of the CIT was milepost 15.44 at Beaver Dam Run. Now, Mr. Riffin just came up here and said, actually, that run is at 15.3. But where's the evidence to support that assertion? There is no record support for Mr. Riffin's assertion now before this court that the Beaver Dam Run is somewhere other than where it was described in the proceedings in which they participated and where they did not assert that that description was incorrect before the board made its decision on April 5th. Now, Mr. Strohmeyer asks, does this require interpretation of the final system plan? Well, the board managed to define the end of the CIT without reference to the final system plan, and they did not raise that issue before the board. But I would suggest, Your Honors, that if every single transaction that in the past somehow involved Conrail, that the board was required to delve into the past and figure out what was transferred and when it was transferred, merely at the assertion of a party and thereby lose jurisdiction, then there's not a single abandonment in the Northeast Corridor that could be achieved without resort to the special court. And that is a broad, overbroad interpretation of what Harsimus, Conrail versus the board, actually says. Mr. Riffin mentioned the Colorado case. Mr. Dooley filed comments. However, that is apples and oranges. The proceeding that Mr. Riffin is referring is a notice proceeding. It is a summary proceeding. Basically, the party comes in and says, I am noticing that in 30 days I'm going to do X. And what the board, as part of its procedure for notice proceedings, is that if there is any controversy, the board will deny the notice and require that the party reapply, either through petition or application, so that those commenters can have their day before the board and be heard. The board did not specifically reference Mr. Dooley's comments, nor did it accept him as a party of record as a litigant before the board. What the board simply said was, there is controversy in this case. You're going to need to deal with this case through the petition or application process. Your Honors, Mr. Riffin also claims that the protective order that was filed before the board was struck, but that is not the case. There was an order issued by the board on January 29th of 2010, which clearly established that the motion for protective order would stay, would not be affected by the motion to strike, because the board wanted the petitioners to have every opportunity to put their evidence into the record. And even though the motion to strike was filed on January 14th, as this court has already noted, Ms. Lowe, Mr. Strohmeyer, and Mr. Riffin filed numerous pleadings before the board actually addressed that motion to strike on March 22nd. Your Honors, the board was weighing the evidence that was presented by MTA that established that there had been no rail activity, no freight rail activity on that line since April of 2005. There had been no overhead activity on that line since the 1970s. That the shippers that were on that line had already sought and found alternative means of moving their goods, and that in the absence of freight rail activity, a burgeoning, a thriving light rail system had grown up, moving, as at least as far as 2008, as many as 25,000 passengers daily. The board, in weighing that evidence against Mr. Riffin's projections, the possibility that a incinerator might be sited, the possibility that Baltimore County might burn its trash at that facility, and the possibility that Baltimore might use freight rail, that projection was not sufficient to overcome that evidence. Your Honors, the board and United States submit that this court deny the petition for review.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, I'm not quite as tall as Mr. Bowles, so I'm not sure if you can hear me, but I hope so. May it please the court, my name is Charles Spitalnik, and I'm counsel for the Maryland Transit Administration in this proceeding. MTA has supported the decision of Norfolk Southern to abandon its freight operations on the line that's the subject of this proceeding since Norfolk Southern first filed its request for abandonment authorization in 2005. MTA acquired the line in 1990 for the express purpose of constructing a light rail network on the corridor, and its mission since that time has been to provide a safe, efficient, and reliable public transportation alternative for the thousands of people who use that line on a daily basis. MTA's commitment to safety has led it to expend substantial resources in order first to build the line, then as the volume of passengers increased and the need for more frequent operations became evident, MTA elected to double track the line, that is to build a second parallel track to avoid the possibility or the need for single for operations in both directions on the same track and to make it possible for bidirectional operations to occur all at the same time to guarantee and preserve the integrity and safety of the light rail passenger service. MTA has stated itself repeatedly in this proceeding that cessation of freight service will promote the safety of the operations. The Norfolk Southern, in its petition for exemption, stated at page 74 of the Joint Appendix, in its verified petition, that safety would be promoted by having freight operations cease on this line. The Baltimore County Executive, James T. Smith, then the Baltimore County Executive, now the Secretary of Transportation for the state of Maryland, said the same thing in the statement that he's provided in support of the petition for exemption. In the record below and in this proceeding, both Ms. Lowe, Mr. Riffin, and the other participants have made much of the fact that there were no complaints about the safety of the operation during the time that MTA and Conrail were operating together on the line. Your Honors, I submit that MTA's conduct speaks for itself in that regard. MTA has expended an enormous amount of resources to make this line safer by both double tracking and by taking the steps necessary to help the shippers that were on the line find other transportation alternatives so that the line could be operated safely without the need for dealing with all of the issues that arise when you have joint use of a line by freight service and light rail service. The STB and the MTA, which are the two entities that are before this court that have experience in dealing with jointly used lines, that is, lines that are used by both freight service and MTA, by freight service and light rail service, have demonstrated by the pleadings and by the arguments that they've made both below and in this court that they believe that the safety of the operations is promoted by having freight service removed and that the public interest favors enhancing the safety of the operation of the line by having the freight service removed in the absence of credible claims or requests for freight service by shippers on the line. The STB reinforced that assessment by its decision that's before the board here, or before the court here, and MTA respectfully submits that petitioners have presented nothing to this court that provides a basis for setting aside that decision. And for all of the reasons that we've stated in our pleadings, both below and in our briefs in this court, we respectfully submit that the petitions for review should be denied. If there are any questions, I'm happy to address them at this time.
Thank you.
things.
All right. Mr. Strohmeyer, do you want a minute?
Yes.
Just one point, Your Honor. When Mr. Bowles started off, he used the statement 13 and a quarter mile long railroad. And if you look at the petition, it's 13.26, not 13 and a quarter. It may sound trivial, but this is the point that I was trying to make with respect to where is the end of the line. And I just would like to submit that the Maryland Transit Administration is basically judicially a stop from arguing anything beyond 15.4, and we still have a discrepancy which has still not been resolved by the testimony given before this court today. And how do we get that last 0.4 of a mile in without interpreting the final system plan? And against that, I would, you know, respectfully hope that the court would consider my argument with respect to that issue.
Thank you. Mr. Intervenor, Mr. Riffin.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe I heard Mr. Dooley say that the line ends at Beaver Dam Run, and if it ends at Beaver Dam Run, that is not Western Run, and the MTA took title to Western Run. So we have a discrepancy in what Mr. Dooley is saying today and what's in the record. That's why I keep saying, I'd like to know where the end of the line is, and it becomes important if we get the opportunity to acquire this line. Mr. Spitolnik has indicated that there wasn't any traffic on this line, and operation of freight somehow impairs the safety of the light rail operation. The counter to that argument is the freight operation occurs when light rail operation does not occur. Light rail has the right to use the line between 6 a.m. and midnight.
Well, the board considered this, didn't it, Mr. Riffin?
Actually, they didn't.
Well, they did because MTA put in evidence as to why it thought joint operation would not enhance safety. And the board considered that.
If you want to consider that as evidence, which is another point,
Under the board's regulations, they're entitled to consider that type of
thing. I'm not sure about that. That's where it is.
Well, the board is interpreting its regulations, and how can you, show that?
It's the Administrative Procedure Act, Your Honor. The Administrative Procedure Act indicates that hearsay evidence might have some weight, but Verstein statements have a lot more weight, and they also, decisions on the APA
Act.
That's
what the board said, basically. That's what its regulation
says. And I'm questioning
it. You give it the weight to which it's
because
due.
The only evidence on safety is the comments made by Mr. Spitolnik. Mm-hmm. Now, he is a well-respected attorney, but he's the attorney for his client. We have nothing in the record from his client. I find that objectionable. I also find it objectionable that we have decisions that say...
You weren't impressed by his argument that the action of MTA manifested a concern about safety by double tracking and paying freight shippers to find alternatives.
What's the underlying reason?
It seemed like the acts of someone who does believe that removing the freight is valuable, and it's hard to see any value it might have other than enhancing safety.
The reason why they paid the shippers is because if they didn't, the shippers would object to the fact that they took the line out of service for 3 years while they did double track it. Double tracking was good.
You make that sound as if double tracking were sort of a frivolous activity of the MTA.
Double tracking is the best thing they did. I don't even object to the fact they took the line out of service for 3 years. What I object to the fact is that he keeps saying, we only have three shippers, and the three shippers that they talk about didn't object. Well, what they failed to tell this court about is the other dozen shippers that objected all over the place, including me. I've been objecting about my lack of service since 2003. I had a dozen rail cars consigned to Cockeysville, and Norfolk Southern adamantly refused to take them there, even though I prepaid the freight. I object to that, and I still object to that to this day, as Your Honor can well tell. Another question. There was some mention ancillary track. The petition filed by Norfolk Southern says ancillary track. Well, ancillary track, accepted track, has a very special meaning. That's accepted track. You don't need permission to abandon accepted track. You don't need permission to abandon ancillary yard spur tracks. You do need express permission to abandon lines of railroad. Now, it's been argued. Norfolk Southern wanted to abandon all that it had the right to operate on. Okay, you might carry that and say, well, that includes the three lines that he didn't talk about. And the board has said, you need to talk about it, and they still haven't talked about it. But what concerns me is the fact that we have another common carrier out there who has the obligation, the common carrier obligation, to operate on those three lines. And that's the MTA. That's my concern. Norfolk Southern has eliminated its right to operate on the Cockeysville Industrial Track, and they've argued that that includes the other three lines. But what we don't have is we don't have an abandonment of the three lines, at least one of which, actually I think the MTA probably has the common carrier obligation on all three of them. At least one, probably all three. And the reason is because when the MTA acquired these three lines, they did it in 1997. They got the CIT in 1990. They were not a common carrier in 1990. And the board held that when you acquired the CIT in 1990, you didn't become a common carrier. I don't have a problem with that. What I have a problem is what happened thereafter in 1997, because in 1994, the MTA became a common carrier when it acquired the Baltimore and Annapolis. And if a common carrier, if an entity becomes a common carrier, and that entity acquires another line of railroad, such as these three lines of railroad, they need permission to do that under 11.323. They didn't ask for it. And when they filed their declaratory order proceeding to ask the board to declare that they're not common carriers on the CIT, they very carefully limited their argument to the CIT. What they did not ask the board was, are we a common carrier with regard to these three other lines because we acquired it after we became a common carrier? They didn't ask that question. And the reason the board didn't address it is because they said in their decision, you didn't ask us to address that, so we're not going to address it, and it's still an unknown issue, and all that's right. What I find disturbing.
So I think we have your argument, and we will take the case under advisement.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
You're welcome.